I often drive home from my work at the post shop along Forest, somewhere just along there opposite the swimming pool, I think it is, there's a house. And if that house were for sale, if it were advertised in the paper, it would probably talk about how many bedrooms it had and how many living areas and bathrooms and so on and so forth. And then probably the last phrase or sentence that would be used would say something like this: needs TLC, or renovator's dream. Now, you've got a picture of what this house looks like, okay? You don't know how many rooms it's got, I've not told you. You don't know how many bathrooms it has, you know very little about it. But most of you know enough that you wouldn't touch it. You wouldn't go near it. The shingles are coming off the roof. And the weatherboards have paint that's peeling off. And the windows are covered in cobwebs, and some of the panes of glass are cracked. A renovator's dream. Well, I have a feeling that if ever that house goes on the market, it won't be renovated. It's most likely that it will be pulled down and half a dozen or even more townhouses put on the same section. But I look at that house as I drive past it every day and I think, I wonder what that was like. It actually looks as though it could be a really nice house. You know, one of the old villas that you see around the place, and some of which have been done up and do look really good. And I can imagine the garden having been dug over, and a nice cottage garden with all those oldie worldy plants there growing up in front of those cracked windows which have been replaced. I could picture that having been renovated, returned to its former state when it was new and bright and shining and the envy of the neighbours. Jeremiah pictures a renovator's dream. He pictures not just a house, not even a city, but a nation that needs some TLC, some tender, loving care. And in this fifth lament, which more than any of the others is a prayer, a plea, a cry to God, he asks for God to come again to Jerusalem, to revisit Judah. And the love that he once showed to this nation, that it might once again be shown. And that this nation that's in such a dilapidated state might be renovated, might be renewed, might be re-inhabited with worshippers of the living God. Remember, O Lord, what has come upon us. Look and behold our reproach. He cries out to the living God, consider our circumstances. You, O Lord, who called us out of bondage and slavery in Egypt, look at what has befallen us. Look at what has come to us. This nation which was once so glorious under the reigns of David and Solomon, this nation which was the envy of all the nations round about, this nation which once was so glorious and so powerful that no nation dared come against it. Look where we've come to. Look what's happened to us. Remember, O Lord. Consider. See. Not that God has forgotten. This is the God who is omniscient. This is the God who knows all things. Jeremiah doesn't think that this God has forgotten. He doesn't think in reality that this God is not looking, is not considering, does not behold their approach. But these words that he uses speak the unspoken word. Lord, act. Lord, do something about our condition. Lord, come again. Revisit us. Bless us once again. Make this nation great once again. See, he says, our inheritance has been turned over to aliens and our houses to foreigners. We have become orphans and waifs. Our mothers are like widows. And here in these two verses, verses 2 and 3, he introduces a section that will follow through to the end of verse 16, in which he describes the ruin of the nation of Israel. He describes the ruin of the nation of Israel. He highlights two aspects to this ruin: that it's a national ruin and that it's a personal ruin. Our inheritance has been turned over to aliens, our houses to foreigners. You see, in Israel, the inheritance was of significance, great significance, so much so that the inheritance that God gave to the 12 tribes of Israel when they first conquered Canaan, and he handed it over to them as the promised inheritance called Abraham on. Every tribe that had its allotted section in this nation would always possess that section of land. And every tribe, every family within the tribe that had its allotted segment would always possess that segment throughout the generations. I've mentioned before that if a family became so poor that it had to sell a portion of land to generate income, then that land really was only being leased. When the year of Jubilee came around, whoever had bought that land would have to give it back. And so the price that was paid for the land that was bought was based on the period of time that was remaining till the next Jubilee. For example, if it was the 45 years from the next Jubilee, someone would pay more for the same piece of land than they would if it was only 5 years till the next Jubilee. In essence, they were leasing the land or renting the land for a period of time, and when the Jubilee came around, the land would go back to the family who had sold it. So important was this idea of inheritance in the nation of Israel. And here they're saying, our inheritance has been turned over to aliens and our houses to foreigners. This is the worst thing that could happen. Bad enough having to sell your house and land to a fellow Israelite, but at least you knew they'd give it back when the Jubilee came. But here their inheritance has gone over to foreigners, to aliens, to people who don't know the laws of Israel, and even if they did know the laws of Israel, would pay no attention to them, wouldn't honour those laws. The nation is in ruin. And the individuals within the nation are in ruin. We have become orphans and waifs. Our mothers are like widows. This has become a personal thing. Each individual in Judah has been affected by the national ruin, so that it has brought upon them personal ruin as well. And these two aspects of national ruin and personal ruin are then expanded on in the future verses. So in verses 4 to 9, Jeremiah describes a little bit more about the nature of the ruin that has come to the nation. We pay even for water to drink, even for wood to put on the fire. The basic necessities of life we have to pay for. They pursue us, pursue at our heels. We labour and have no rest. Now that phrase in verse 5, they pursue at our heels. The word translated heels is literally necks. And perhaps it would be better to think of it in terms of the pursuit of Israel by its enemies has reached a point where they are prostrate on the ground with their enemy's foot on their neck. They are utterly in subjection to their enemies. We labour and have no rest. We've given our hand to the Egyptians and the Assyrians to be satisfied with bread. We're not our own. We now belong to our enemies. Servants rule over us. There is none to deliver us from their hand. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. They're reliant on their enemies, on the people who have overrun them, for safety. They go out into the wilderness and try and make a life for themselves there. Then the Bedouin are going to come and harass them and ransack their camps and steal whatever possessions are left to them. And so they take refuge in the cities where they're slaves of those who have overrun them. Nowhere can they escape from the destruction that has come upon this land. It is in absolute ruin. See how he goes on to describe the personal ruin of these people. As hot as an oven because of the fever of famine. There's no food to eat. There's nothing to sustain them. They're in the fever of famine. Their women, their maidens have been ravished. They've been raped. Their princes have been hung up by their hands. Not that they have been executed, but they've been humiliated and tortured. Their elders, they're not respected. The young men, well, they ground at the millstones, something that would have been a humiliation to any man in Israel. This was particularly the woman's task or the task of slaves. Boys stagger under loads of wood. The elders have ceased gathering at the gate, and the young men from their music. Life is ruined. There is no joy for them anymore. Everything has turned sour in Jerusalem. But not only is there national ruin in a political, territorial, and physical way, not only is there personal ruin in this physical suffering that each person endures, but spiritual ruin has come into the land of Israel as well. That's reflected in the words of verses 15 and 16. The joy of our heart has ceased, our dance has turned into mourning, the crown has fallen from our head. What was the crown of Israel but the temple that stood in Jerusalem? Now a ruin. All its glory has been stolen away to Babylon. that dancing of joy as David returned the Ark of the Covenant to its rightful place in Jerusalem and became the centre of their worship. Now that joy has turned to mourning. No more dancing in the streets of Jerusalem now. No more festivities. As we saw in an earlier lament, the roads are quiet. No worshippers now making pilgrimages to Jerusalem for the three annual feasts that took place there. No, spiritual ruin has come to this land. And it's highlighted at the end of verse 16. Woe to us, for we have sinned. And here then is the acknowledgement of why all this has happened. It's come. Oh, but the more observant of you will have noted, I've skipped verse 7. Our fathers sinned, but we bear their iniquities. Well, what do we make of that? Is Jeremiah pleading innocence here? Is he claiming that this suffering that they're enduring is actually somewhat unjust? That it's their fathers who have sinned and they are bearing the iniquities of their father's sin? They're bearing the results, the consequences of that? Well, we need to let Jeremiah speak for himself, and we need to reflect on the other laments that have preceded this, which ought to form for us a context in which to understand this verse, but we're also to bear in mind what Jeremiah had to prophesy to Israel before any of these events actually took place. They were warned concerning the terrible destruction that would come against their land, and they were told that they would indeed be subjugated and put under captivity by their enemies. The passage speaks about the sin of the fathers of this generation and the fact that God was going to judge Israel because of the sin of the fathers. But it goes on to say, and you also have sinned far more greatly than your fathers. And that's the point, that yes, our fathers sinned, Jeremiah says in verse 7. And we do bear their iniquities. We do live with the consequences of our fathers' sins. But verse 16, woe to us, for we have sinned. Jeremiah isn't for a moment blaming entirely on their fathers. What he's pointing to is the fact that this isn't just one generation, or even two generations. This has gone on for a number of generations. And for a number of generations, God has been persisting with these people, sending prophets to these people, warning them that if they continue in their attitude of rejecting him and worshipping the foreign gods, that condemnation and judgment and desolation will come to Jerusalem, pleading with them to return to him. And the various kings, there were brief periods of a return to the worship of the living God, but soon people were back to worshipping the Baals and the Ashtoreths and the gods of the nations around them, and things went worse and worse and worse, until eventually God fulfills his promise of destruction and doom. Ruin has come to Jerusalem, to Judah, to the nation of God's blessing. Why? Because they sinned. because they turned away from his laws, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. Because they followed godless kings and obeyed godless directions from those who would not honour the true and living God. And they had no excuse. And God brought that promised destruction. But Jeremiah doesn't leave Israel destroyed, Jerusalem in ruins, the temple desecrated. He goes on to express a desire for restoration. That's why he begins the whole chapter by saying, "Remember, O Lord, what has come upon us." And in verse 17, he goes on through to verse 22 to express the desire of his heart and the desire of every godly heart that remained among the Israelites, that God would come again and that God would rebuild the ruins and restore the glory of Israel. He expresses first concern about the city of God in verses 17 and 18. Because of this, because the crown has fallen from our head, because the joy of our hearts has ceased and our dancing has turned into mourning, because of this our heart is faint. Because of these things our eyes grow dim, that is, with tears blurring the vision. Because of Mount Zion, which is desolate, with foxes, or perhaps more accurately, jackals, walking about in it. Such is the desolation of Jerusalem that these jackals, a creature that avoids human company at all costs, walks freely about on Mount Zion, through the streets of once populous Jerusalem where God was worshipped. And Jeremiah is saying in these verses, our hearts faint, our eyes are filled with tears because of the desolation of Jerusalem. Because God is no longer worshipped there. Because God's name is no longer honoured there. And because the nations around ridicule Israel and the God of Israel, because in their view, he hasn't been able to keep them safe from their enemies. Because he hasn't been able to defend their walls and keep their temple sacred. He's concerned. See, a change is taking place in the people of Israel. They're turning now to realize the destructiveness of their behavior and that it has brought Jerusalem into dishonor and the God of Jerusalem into disgrace. But Jeremiah reminds us that the Lord remains forever. And his throne from generation to generation. Oh, there's no palace in Jerusalem anymore. There's not even the temple on Mount Zion anymore. Oh, but God still remains. Oh, he's still sitting on his throne. He's still the sovereign ruler of the universe. Jerusalem may be desolate. The temple may be destroyed. The people may well be scattered. The nation of Israel may well be on the verge of oblivion, but the God of Israel still sits on his throne. He is the God who controls all things that are going on in the world. God is bringing about his purposes. Jeremiah reminds us this. And so he pleads to God, why do you forget us forever? Forsake us for so long a time. He's only just begun a period of God's forsaking Israel. He's only just a few months after Jerusalem has been destroyed. He knows that God has promised 70 years of captivity, and it already feels like an age to him. And as the years go by, perhaps more and more of the people of Israel will feel, will you forget us forever? Will you forsake us for so long? Why? Why, Lord? Turn us back to you. We will be restored. Renew our days as of old. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are very angry with us. Not that Jeremiah thinks for a moment that he has been utterly rejected by God. It's almost a rhetorical question here. Have you utterly rejected us? Are you so very angry with us that you refuse to restore us? Absolutely not. God is faithful to his promises. And here's the whole point of verse 21. Jeremiah prays, turn us back to you, O Lord, and we will be restored. You see, Jeremiah realizes that these people of Israel who are scattered through the nations, they're not going to turn of their own accord. They're not going to return to the Lord unless he turns them back, unless he restores them. That it's his work. That their restoration doesn't depend upon them. Their restoration depends upon God's faithfulness to his promises. And though it may well seem a long time, God's patience, God's willingness to wait, is not a mark of his forgetfulness, but his mark of doing a job thoroughly and well. They must learn the reality of their sin. And it must be said, for all Israel was to continue in or to pursue in future, they never again worshipped false gods. They never again went to worship idols, Baals and Ashtoreths. God taught them the lesson, and he restored them to Jerusalem. What are we to take from all of this? How are we to understand these words for ourselves? Well, surely we must examine our own lives, as I've repeatedly said as we have gone through this book of Lamentations, because the description that we have in this book is of the people of God scattered and of the city of God in desolation and disgrace. And we cannot, in integrity, apply that to any nation that is on the earth today. We cannot say that, well, the words in the 21st century is that New Zealand has turned its back on its Christian heritage and it must return to the Lord, and the Lord will abundantly pardon and will make this land great and so on and so forth. New Zealand isn't the parallel to Jerusalem and Israel. It's the church. And as we read these words, we must think, now, has this got anything to say to us about the church? Has this book of Lamentations, does it point us to anything in the church that we should be considering? And we know, if we know our history of the church, we know that the church of Jesus Christ has gone through periods of great blessing, when it has had an enormous influence on whole nations. And often nations have become great because so many of the populace have worshipped the living God. And we know too that the church has gone through times that can be described as desolate times. Times when Christians are scattered, they're few and far between. When the glory of the church has virtually been snuffed out. And where the God of the church is derided. And the question that we must ask is, what sort of a period are we going through now? In the ebb and flow of spirituality in the human heart, are we on the crest of a wave? Or are we down in the trough? Are we going up or going down? Where does the church lie? And as we ask such questions, they must surely be connected with, well, how are we as Christians living before a holy God? The destruction of Jerusalem and of Judah is directly related to the corrupt will of Israel. And we must ask ourselves, well, how are we living before God? Have we begun to imbibe the philosophies of the world? And do the ideas of the culture around us mould our characters and our behaviour more than the Word of God and the glory of God? And as we examine ourselves, perhaps we need to face some hard truths about the degree to which we have departed from the living God and from the ways of God. Is the church in disgrace today? Well, we can look at many areas of the church and say, absolutely. Wouldn't be hard to do. And I could present you with a day full of illustrations of how different denominations and different congregations have brought the name of God into dishonor. But that's hardly the point. What about us? What about this congregation that meets here each Sunday morning? How are we living for God? How are we serving God? What part does God play in our lives as individuals and as a congregation of his people? And to what degree are we willing to sacrifice ourselves, to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, as Paul puts it, in service for God, in pursuing holiness in our lives as individuals, in proclaiming the message of salvation to those who walk in darkness, to encouraging one another, helping one another, stirring one another up to love and good works. Are we a desolate church? Devoid of some of these things? Well, hopefully not. But are they there in the strength that they ought to be there and could be there if we were more devoted to our God and more devoted to the people among whom we worship our God? Oh, but it's a day of small things. We mustn't despise the day of small things. You hear a note of sarcasm? That statement comes from Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 10. Who has despised the day of small things? Zechariah was encouraging a people who had just returned from the captivity that Jeremiah is lamenting. They've gone to Jerusalem, and what do they see? Well, the weeds are taller now than when Jeremiah saw Jerusalem. And the rubble shows some weathering, whereas when Jeremiah saw it, it had newly fallen from the walls of the temple and the city. But it was still a ruined Jerusalem. And here were a few stragglers left there who have picked their way through the 70 years of captivity. And here are more who have returned from Babylon with the instruction from Cyrus, king of Persia, who has overthrown the Babylonian Empire. Instruction to rebuild the temple. And here some work has begun on it, and the foundation is laid, but oh, there are so many obstacles. Who has despised the day of small things? Who has despised the day that the foundations of the temple were laid, realizing that it would never be as glorious as the temple of Solomon? Who has despised those things? Zechariah asks. But he doesn't ask it in such a way as to encourage the people just to, well, it's a day of small things. We just have to, well, live with it. His point is that, yes, it's a day of small things, but it's leading to something greater, something better. And God promised through Ezekiel, through Haggai, that this temple, despised as it may have been by some, would actually be more glorious than Solomon's. For this temple would be visited by God himself, incarnated in Jesus Christ. What an honor for such a small thing. My point is this, that we can look around us in this world and we can feel as though we are living in a day of small things. Perhaps we are. But we need a vision for the future. God is building a temple. A glorious temple. And he's putting it together with living stones. And it's built upon the foundation of his Son who gave his life for us. And on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. And it will one day be glorious. And we're a part of it. And we are working for it. Oh, we must not despise the day of small things. But neither should we focus on the day of small things. Otherwise, where will we get our motivation to struggle through the hard days, to pursue holiness, to mortify the flesh that seems to have such a life of its own and drag us down so often? How are we going to fight these battles if we allow ourselves to become control things? Don't despise such days, but look for the glorious days. Long for the glorious days. Cry out to God for a restoration of the glory of the church. When the church has seen immense numbers of people being turned from darkness to light, from the worship of self to the worship of the living God, God can do it again. And he will do it again. When we pray to him, turn us back to you, O Lord, and we will be restored. And when we're willing to take the sword in the hand, and take the trowel in the hand, and fight for the glory of God, and build for the glory of God. God has not utterly rejected us. His love is seen in the face of Jesus Christ, for whom we work, for whom we labour and serve and pray. Lord, restore us. Lord, be glorified in us. Lord, let the society in which we live know that there is a God in this world and that we worship Him. And may the Lord use us to bring about revival, restoration, renewal.